you and I back together again, chatting it up and wrapping up a busy week, Friday, March 22nd, 2024. On Connecticut Today, we looked at a proposed ballot change that could affect a major third-party designation in the state. And we also heard from former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso on that same controversy. Glastonbury GOP State Rep. Steve Weir stopped by to chat about a possible expansion of Connecticut's paid medical leave program.
Because of what happened in this election cycle, particularly in the city of Bridgeport and other spots around the state. Huh? Is that what we have going here? How about this? And you kind of knew this would happen. Connecticut bill aims to get rid of voter confusion. Wink, wink, wink. And it may take the independent party with it. What a shock. What a shock. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Story here by Allison Cross. In the Hartford Current, independents in the state are decrying a provision in a proposed election integrity bill they say would destroy their caucus by requiring the Independent Party of Connecticut to take on a new name. Now, Connecticut has an independent party. This is not independent voters. These are not unaffiliated voters. That's different. The Independent Party proudly calls itself independent to show their independence from the Republicans and from the majority in control Democrats. But now, for some reason, wink, wink, that's a rhetorical for some reason. I think you're smart enough to understand where this is going. An election integrity bill, for some reason, says, hey, we can't have the Independent Party of Connecticut calling itself the Independent Party because that's, they say that would confuse voters. I don't know. Are the powers that be in Hartford, the Democratic majority in Hartford, what are they so afraid of? Oh, I know. Yeah. By the way, didn't John Gomes run on an independent line in one of his go-rounds with Joe Ganim? Oh, yeah. Shocking, huh? House Bill 5498 would bar political parties from using the term independent in their titles. The name change provision is one of more than a dozen election and security proposals included in this bill. Gee, why do you think that's in the bill? Any idea? Any thought as to why that may be in the bill? At a public hearing this past Monday, proponents of the bill who defended the name change as necessary to avoid confusion among voters appeared open to appeals by the Independent Party members to seek a less drastic solution. Well, let me ask you this, and this is, again, is kind of rhetorical here. What's wrong with calling a party the Independent Party? It's not the same as non-affiliated. It's not the same as unaffiliated. I wonder who might be, any guesses out there? Who might be trying to get rid of the independent party's name as independent? Any thoughts? Just wondering. If it is passed as written, HB 5498 would prohibit political parties from using names that incorporate unaffiliated or unenrolled, independent, or any other terms to affiliated, enrolled, or dependent. If the bill passes, any party that contains such words in its name, including the Independent Party, must apply to reserve a new title by January 1, 2025. Gee, I'm shocked. I'm shocked here. Who do you think in the state? Who do you think in Bridgeport? Who do you think in New Haven? Who do you think in Hartford might want to get the name independent out there? Gee, didn't John Gomes? No, this would never be political payback, would it? No, of course not. While the bill states that each party shall retain all rights earned under its previous name, including ballot access and cross-endorsement privileges, Michael Telesca, who we've had on this show, the state chair of the Independent Party, said there are no provisions dictating whether currently enrolled party members will automatically roll over to the new party name. I'm shocked. Really? I wonder why there's no provision that the party members who are in the party right now might be automatically enrolled in the new party. Gee, who do you think might be behind that? Yeah, according to Telesca, 30,000 votes in the state are registered with the independent parties. A lot of votes there, huh? Yeah, votes that maybe, like in Bridgeport, could influence future elections? Oh, yeah. At a public hearing on Monday, Telesca says the party's name and its recognition across the state have been hard-earned. He said, quote, "There's no good reason to take our name away from us unless you want to destroy our party and deny the voters a real third party on the ballot." Mike, come on. I got to get Mike on the show here. Mike, you're kidding. Who would want to... What political force in Connecticut would want to destroy the Independent Party? Let me think now. Secretary of the State Stephanie Thomas said the provision is designed to eliminate confusion for voters. Madam Secretary, with all due respect, and I think you're doing a good job so far, that's crap. And you know it's crap. And anybody with a functioning brain knows this is crap. Why do I say that? Folks, you watch and listen to the same news I do generally. We talk about it here every Monday through Friday from 2 to 6. Seriously, did I miss the stories of mass voter confusion? Did I? Honestly. In 2019, when I started working here up through 2023, in 2019, was there any mass voter confusion? Did you know anybody who said, geez, I was so confused. I didn't know independent didn't mean independent. Who's coming up with this? Did we hear about this? This time around, the only thing we heard this time around about the Independent Party is how some candidates, when they couldn't get on the Republican or the Democratic line in some cities or towns, they were able to latch on to the Independent Party. Like, oh, wait a minute. We can't have that, can we? No. No, we can't have... other candidates charging the status quo. Look, I know what you're going to say. Well, Paul, it's voter confusion. No, it's not. Voters are smarter than you think. All this ongoing garbage that we have all the time about, well, it's so tough to vote and voter access and voter recognition and voters are confused. No, they're not. They're not. People are a lot more smarter than people think. Stephanie Thomas saying, we're not trying to eradicate the Independent Party. They would still exist. They would just have a different name. Again, I ask, why is this coming up now? Why do you think, in light of what just happened in Bridgeport and other places around the state where there are other Independent Party candidates, who's so afraid of this? Rhetorical question. Connecticut's voter registration form asks, do you wish to enroll in a political party? Applicants can either check no, I do not wish to enroll in a party at this time, or yes, if they answer yes, applicants must either check the Democrat or Republican party or write in a party name on the other line. Stephanie Thomas says she often encounters confusion among prospective voters at registration drives on college campuses. Okay, well, Madam Secretary, with all due respect, it's their confusion. They're too dumb to understand this. Thomas said it's becoming a problem when unwitting Independent Party members try to cast a ballot in a primary election. Well, how often does that happen, honestly? In Connecticut, unaffiliated voters have a longer grace period to enroll in a new party before a primary. Ah, there we go. Stephanie Thomas said the issue has led to a lot of, here we go, disenfranchisement, the magic D word. Folks, I'm sorry. I find this. Now, come on. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. am I the only guy in the room here, in the bar, in the restaurant? Am I the only guy that finds this a little odd here that right after the big mess we had in Bridgeport, four rounds worth, and some other, you know, election tangles around the state where the independent party line was used, whether or not the party chair wanted it to happen. am I the only guy that finds this a little odd? Really? And by the way, this is part of a voter integrity bill? Really? How about we concentrate on the drop boxes where allegedly crimes are still being committed instead of trying to force the independent party that is proud of their independence and smart enough to understand that independence is different from uncommitted and unaffiliated? Why don't we leave them alone? They're not the problem. Jose in Shelton. Jose, what's up?
Hey, how you doing,
hey,
Paul?
Hey.
Why are the legislators wasting their time on this? This is nothing. This independent is just a name.
It sounds like, Jose, they're trying to get back at people who use the independent party line to challenge the status quo, to challenge
the
power.
You could have, remember Weicker had a Connecticut party?
Yeah, yeah.
They're all independents. You got the Green Party, the Green Leaf Party, the Tree Party.
Yeah.
It's just a name. So what they're trying to say is you can't use that word independent. You'd have to say the Two Roads Party.
Yeah, why are they Jose, why do you think they're suddenly doing this time around? Why do you think?
It's because of the mayor's election.
Thank you, my friend.
I got breaking news for you.
Yeah.
See, the legislature, they're wasting all this money and time on this nonsense.
Yeah.
What you got to do with the legislators, you got to, I think they only make $28,000.
No.
You got to hike their salaries.
No, Jose, Jose.
People.
Jose, their salaries got hiked a couple of years ago. They make $45,000 now.
Oh, they make $45,000 now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm proposing this for all legislators like this. You would get better legislators. They should raise all the legislators' salaries to $100,000. They should give them all a company car.
Yeah.
And they should build them all condos up in Hartford. And then you would get quality people instead of these guys wasting all this money on independent. Why are they named independent?
Yeah.
It's just a name. It's a label.
Jose,
what do you think of that proposal, Paul?
Jose, I think you've been dipping into those magic mushrooms. That's what I think, Jose. Have a great weekend. $100,000 a year. Chris Caruso joins us to put a capper on the week and give us his thoughts as to what has transpired and what may transpire. Chris, is Paul here? How are you, sir?
Paul, how's everything going?
Chris, I can't complain, but Chris, I got to tell you, this move now to make the independent party change their name in Hartford. Chris, maybe I'm a cynic. I apologize, Mr. Caruso, if I am.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm a cynic, but you know, Chris, they say timing is everything in life. And
it's true.
I saw this today and I said, I wonder why this has suddenly become an issue, Chris. Now, they're claiming, Chris, you probably saw, voter confusion. All right.
Yeah. There you go. That always works. Voter confusion is so general that it always works.
Chris, are you buying any of this or not?
You know, what troubles me, Paul, if it's attached to the bill with the absentee ballot and election reforms, it could effectively pull the bill down. So, you know, if they want to do something like this, do a separate bill where it's not lumped in with the other election reforms that are critical. But, you know, frankly, it seems to me when I read the article, and I have no background of it, when I read the article, the Secretary of the State is the one who's proposing this based on voter confusion. So the simplest thing is just to make an amendment to the voter card when people sign up. You know, if the word unaffiliated and independent is confusing, then have an explanation on the card and you check off, you know, unaffiliated, which is different in many ways than independent, because unaffiliated means you're not connected with either one of the major parties in the state, the Democrat or Republican. So I think it's more of a clerical change on the card that would make it work, I think, in my opinion. And it would and all the agita would go away.
Yeah, but Chris, and listen, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, don't get me wrong, but I'm reading this and I'm saying, well, you know, there was this big cha-cha with John Gomes and the Independent Party during the last several rounds here, and Mike Telesco, I think, said, listen, don't do it, and he was going to do it. And, you know, Chris, you read in that article, people have said, no, we want to claim independence from the Republicans and from the Democrats, and the party's been around, Chris, since 2008. So why all of a sudden now? I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's connected to John Gomes. I really don't. You know, I think the word unaffiliated has been around for as long as I remember, as long as I've been involved in politics. And it meant that you weren't affiliating with either party. You wanted to stay out of being affiliated with a party, per se, not so much the independent. And when you do these cards, you don't say you want to be a Democrat, Republican, or the, you know, the pot and pan party. You know, there's no pot and pan independent party. So I just think an amendment on the card, leave everything the way it is and just clarify unaffiliated. And that way you don't have to change the word independent, or, you know, it just seems to me just a lot of unnecessary drama, frankly. That's, you know, that's why I look at it, Paul. I don't have any background on it, but it just seems to me, leave everything the way it is and just clarify what unaffiliated is. If voters are confused, which possibly could be unaffiliated to independent, just clarify it on the card, you know?
Yeah. So. Some other things, Chris. We saw some further clarification out of the Secretary of the State's office from those initial four charges that she sent on to the State Election Enforcement Commission. And now, Chris, we're getting more clarification of at least the, and I know it's innocent until proven guilty, but there's more stuff they're looking into. You know, two of the four, they're all four of them you don't like, but, you know, the one where we apparently had some inspectors just did a little pop survey and they found that eight out of 63 people got unsolicited absentee ballots. And then, of course, another mess apparently with the absentee ballot drop boxes caught on video.
Yeah. No, you know, Paul, you know, I suggested, you know, when the Secretary of the State was asking for help with people in the community to have your eyes open on primary day, election day, I wrote to her and asked her that there should be some spot checks, you know, actually making calls or stopping by people's houses who have applied for absentees. And I'm really happy that she did that. I thought that's the right thing to do because, you know, you could be a monitor and sit at City Hall, but you'll never know what's going out in the field, what's going out on the various houses and people that have applied for absentee. So I think that was great, and that should be done more regularly. That should be put into the statute. But, you know, as her people went out and knocked on doors or made phone calls or what have you, you see the abuse that takes place. That's why the application process, you know, when people get the applications and they go to someone's home and they ask them to fill it out, that has to be, I think, limited. I really think, as I mentioned, you should limit that to about five applications per person, so that way there isn't hundreds of applications out there unnecessarily. That's one way. Secondly, these drop boxes are a problem. And I don't know why we just don't take them out. We put them in for COVID, which was understandable, but COVID is over. And the other thing, you know, if someone goes to a mailbox and drops off an absentee, as it was in the past before we had the ballot boxes, that was even, as far as a violation of law, it was federal violation of law.
Yeah.
You know, to use the mail for that purpose. So I think do away with the drop box. I think use the mailboxes. People have to use the mailbox. There's a camera on every street corner in Bridgeport, so the mailboxes are going to be covered as well. And I think even the post office has cameras out there as well. So you're going to cover that. So I think take away the box, which is unnecessary and, frankly, a temptation for people. But you see what's happening. People are still using things illegally and going about the abuse the way they are. So I think there's some strong pieces in the legislation, Paul, that I think is great. But we've got to do more from the source, which is actually the application and people going door to door, getting people to fill it out in order to get a ballot. So that's where the abuse is, you know?
Yeah, Chris, finally, it looks like there's at least a little bit of a truce here as the school superintendent, Carmela Levy-David, has, I guess, along with Mayor Ganim, consented to taking a closer look and maybe a study group here at the six or so schools that she says because of the physical plant and also because of the results or non-results of these students need to be shut down.
Right. And I think it's a good move. The mayor came out. I encouraged the mayor, frankly, when I spoke to him to come out and support her on this. And I'll be honest with you, she's the first superintendent, as I can remember, that had the courage to come out and say these six schools need to be closed. And she frankly exposed the problems in those schools, poor academic performance, poor structural integrity of those buildings. So she did it. She needed to have the support. And from what I understand, other elected officials are supporting her as well. And I think that's the right thing to do. You know, she's brought it out. She said, hey, here's the problem. We need to address it. And it should be. You know, no kid should be in a school building where there's asbestos, you know, in the floor or furnaces that are breaking down, or a school that was built 5 years after Edison invented the light bulb. Okay? So, and you know, Paul, the interesting thing with Sheridan School, which was the leadership center, that school 20 years ago was closed for polling. So we couldn't vote there anymore because it was not ADA accessible. And we had elderly people in particular falling down the stairs, breaking their hip or wrist or something. Now, if you close the school because you can't vote there, but you let the kids still go there and others, what? It makes no sense. So, you know, my hat's off to the superintendent. As I've said, you know, politically, maybe it could have been handled differently, but we didn't hire her to be a politician. We hired her to be an educator, to be the superintendent of the schools with qualifications, with experience, with knowledge, and she's made that known. So I my hat's off to her, and I think now the mayor's on board, other elected officials. I think the study is good to do. To look into it deeper, and that's fine. But you know, now the jack is out of the box. Mm-hmm. So there's no way you're going to put it back in again. And I think that's good for the school system, and it's good for Bridgeport. So you know, my hat's off to her. And you know, when you look at it, Paul, we've got some really competent department heads now. Mm-hmm. She, the police chief, the fire department, the city attorney. You've got to build on that competency now. And support these people who are professionals in their area. And, you know, you can have oversight, but you have to support them.
Yeah, and Chris, finally, it must be so uber frustrating to people from the mayor on down, in the system, out of the system, parents, grandparents, politicians, students, everybody, to you see the millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars that's put by statute quite properly into public education every year. But as you say, we're still dealing with school buildings that are detrimental to the health of students. It is mind-boggling how this is still going on in the year 2024.
And you know, the truth of it, Paul, if we spend the money properly, there's more money available from the state. You know, part of it is how we use the money, how do we use it effectively. And, you know, when you have the school system, which is financially strapped, spending $31 million to bus special needs students, special education students, out of Bridgeport to other schools makes no sense. And, you know, no one knew about that, frankly. That wasn't out in the public consumption. No one knew about it. Now she's exposed and said, you know, it's better to take our children that have special needs and keep them within our district, right? It's much better transporting-wise. It's much better for those kids. It makes perfect sense, and it saves a tremendous amount of money that can be used to help those kids and other kids in the system. And I think we're going to see more of that from her. Now, you know, you have the detractors that say, you know, she's too direct, she's too blunt. Well, you know what? Who cares? You know, I was on Facebook today and I said, who cares? You know? And I said, she's not a politician.
Yeah.
You know why I don't care, Paul? Because she's trying.
Yes.
And let me tell you, if you're a little blunt and you're a little tough, who cares? You're trying. And that's all I ask of people is try because in the long run, it's going to make Bridgeport better. It really will. And you know, finally, someone has the courage to step up and the firmity to say, you know, these are problem schools. We need to address them. And but, you know, there's always going to be the detractors. You're not going to stop that. But I think we've got to support her. And, you know, there's something to be said, Paul, about an outsider. She was from Texas coming in here. She wasn't part of the system. I've always said over the years, it's good to get outside people sometimes to lead systems because they look at the system differently and they bring their life experiences into the system in Bridgeport, which at times needs to be addressed. So, again, my hat's off to her, and, you know, I'm very supportive of her, and I know a lot of people are, and that's critical for the school system.
Absolutely. Chris, thank you as always for your perspectives. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk next week. Thank you, sir.
You too, Paul.
All right, there you go. Chris Caruso lending his perspectives to the end of the week. Couple of interesting items coming before the Labor Committee over the past few days, one having to do with restaurants and bars, another having to do with paid sick leave days, an expansion that's been proposed by the majority Democrats of that program here in the state. Joining us right now to chat about that is Glastonbury Hebron Republican State Rep Steve Ware, representing the 55th General Assembly District. Hey, Steve, it's Paul here at WICC. How are you? Thanks for stopping by.
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the paid sick leave thing, Steve. Now, outline to some of my listeners who may not be familiar with the plan, where does it stand now, and what is the proposal here for expansion of this?
Well, currently, I mean, are you asking the current law, which was enacted before I joined the legislature? I'm in my second year, first term, second year. And the current law limits paid sick leave or mandates paid sick leave to companies that employ 50 or more employees at the moment. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, basically the proposal is to bring that number down to any company that employs one or more employees.
Wow.
And they've expanded some of the proposals, have expanded some of the ways in which one may use paid sick leave and broadened the term of what a family means. But yeah, that's basically it. And there are three bills that basically do the same thing. And the hope, you know, I know the governor has a bill, the state, the House Democrats have a bill. The House Democrats and the Senate Democrats each have a bill. So there are three potential vessels for this concept to get passed this year.
Yeah, Steve, I always thought, and this is just me, and my family had a small business for years, decades, years ago. I always thought that maybe 50 employees was a little high. But then I said to myself, well, they're going to expand it. I wonder what the number will be. And I think, Steve, for some businesses to go from 50, so where it would kick into one employee, I don't know about you, but what was the consensus on that? Were there any members, including maybe yourself, who said, hey, going from 50 down to just one single employee might be too much too quickly?
Well, I can tell you the four Republicans who sit on the Labor Committee all felt that way. Mm-hmm. Several of us operate, actually, I believe all four of us operate small businesses. And at least one of us has no employees. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, he cited that that might be, you know, this is one of the many reasons why he would be hesitant to hire that first employee, because mm-hmm. it's so onerous, just the amount of regulations. But, you know, I've owned several small businesses in my lifetime. Okay. The last business, the large business I sold a couple years ago, and we had around 50 employees. And even at the, you know, when I had 10 employees, this market is so tight to find good help that businesses are already doing this on their own accord. They don't, you know, so our argument was you don't need a state mandate. You know, I was against it when it was 50 employees. I'm against it when it's 30, 20, 10, and 1, because most businesses are making some sort of accommodation to attract and retain employees. And that was noted. I don't remember the exact number, but the mm-hmm. overwhelming majority of businesses in the state are doing this already. So what do we need a state mandate to tell a business how they may conduct their business? The employee may say, I don't want time off, but in exchange, I want something else. And I don't know what that is, maybe a company car, whatever. And by mandating this, we have possibly taken away the ability for an employee and an employer to negotiate the terms that work best for the two of them.
Republican State Rep. Steve Weir is the guest representing parts of Andover, Bolton, Glastonbury, Hebron, and Marlborough, the 55th General Assembly District. So, Steve, this did come out of committee, I guess. So where does this stand? Do you anticipate this sick leave provision or a combination of some of the bills? Now, this is an election year. We all know that. Getting out of committee is one thing. Do you anticipate this getting a floor vote in either the House and or the Senate?
You know, it's hard for me to tell. I know the proponents of the bill have, they certainly are speaking as if that's a foregone conclusion. I think, as you pointed out, that at some number, people, generally speaking, may think this is a reasonable proposal and maybe not as controversial as the EVs. But I think as people realize, if you think about it through the lens of the employer, to the fact that the state of Connecticut already has a horrible reputation is for being business friendly. And if our goal is to attract and retain businesses, you want to have an environment that is not as restrictive as we have it. So if anything, I would be thinking that we want to loosen restrictions to bring businesses in. So again, at face value, people say, geez, it seems reasonable to me. Why wouldn't all companies have to offer paid sick leave? But when you look at what that could do to a small business, the onerous costs of the back office type, there's a lot of administrative work that goes into tracking these things and being compliant, the penalties that are potentially out there for noncompliance. It's a lot. So while it seems nice in theory, I think that the businesses who want to offer it should be allowed to, should continue to offer it. And those who don't, for whatever reason, the employees have choice, right? That may be a place that isn't going to work for them, and they're going to go for a place that offers that.
Yeah, and Steve, you mentioned yourself being a business owner and other business owners. One thing I've always wondered about this, and you can comment and tell me if I'm nuts or not, but what about if you have a scenario where, you're forced to provide sick leave, right? And, somebody has to go home and deal with something, whatever, with a relative or a friend, whatever. And then I would imagine sometimes, Steve, these business owners have to bring in, depending upon the business, if they can't shift the work off to everybody else, they've kind of got to bring in a temp, right? And I would think that that might be another cost. And then you have a temp there who, may be pretty darn good at what they do, and it may, in kind of a perverse way, be difficult to get rid of that temp when that worker wants to come back. I mean, I can understand how, if you mandate this, it also may, in some way, shape, or form, kind of disrupt the workplace continuity a bit, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do. I think I just want to make clear that this particular bill offers up to 40 hours of paid sick leave. So this is, to me, this is a short term. This is for the person who, catches the flu perhaps, or a cold, and or a family member. To maybe more in line, and I don't want to make assumptions, but more in line of what you're mentioning is the paid family medical leave, which is more the short to mid to long term. And that, I made the, we've made the distinction that at that particular service, that particular offering from the state is underutilized. And so our proposal, it's been mentioned that, why don't we reform that so that people are utilizing it more rather than come up with another unneeded, another service. And then the employees are the ones who are paying into that paid family medical leave.
Sure.
They have to have a chance to use those benefits versus here. This is strictly, these costs are borne solely by the employer.
Yeah, and I did read, I'm glad you brought that up, Steve, because I did read, I've seen stories popping up where, I guess, Steve, did the state overestimate, or were there overestimates as to how the paid family and medical leave thing, how many people would take advantage of it? Because I did read that a lot of these claims are denied.
Yeah, I think the testimony from the Paid Family Medical Leave Authority was that 75% of the claims are being approved.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a whole segment of the population who is ineligible to use that leave first, and that is people who have coverage by their employer.
Sure.
They're mandated to use that first. So in essence, your employees are paying, you know, we each have 0.5% of our paycheck taken out.
Oh, yeah.
And then we're forced to use our employer's paid family medical leave first. So, you know, I liken this to, you know, wage theft on behalf of the government. Mm. I've maintained for a long time that this paid family medical leave is a house of cards. And the only thing propping it up is the fact that it's underutilized. But at any rate, it's frustrating to me to see another mandate upon small businesses where most of the people are just trying to survive. And here we go and add another hurdle for them to go over.
Yeah. And finally, as we segue from the paid family and medical leave to the paid sick time, and I know the Labor Committee is currently amidst in a big debate, and I believe there was a vote the other day to under pressure from some labor groups to get rid of the, I guess they call the tipped wage and make everybody in the restaurant and bar industry work for the full minimum, still thinking they're going to get tips. And I did talk with people from the restaurant association, and Steve, I know they're not happy, and apparently there has not been a big groundswell of people screaming to get rid of a system that I know the waiters and waitresses that I see on the regular level, scale are pretty happy with.
Yes, you made several really good points, and I'm sure we're short on time, but the fact of the matter is we didn't hear from many, there were very few servers who showed up to testify. The ones who did show up were in associated with some of these national groups, so they showed up wearing the unified T-shirts and all that. But the big push, this is a national effort. And it's, you know, they're trying to push it in other cities and in other states. In some cases they have, but the real success of this, you know, nobody's seen these things in action for a long period of time. And so to me, it's most important to hear from our Connecticut servers and bartenders. And I think, you know, if you heard from the Connecticut Restaurant Association, then you heard that the average server is making $28 to $30 an hour.
Not too
and
shabby.
The bartenders are making nearing $40 an hour on average. So I think there's no compelling, if we're not going to hear from people in Connecticut with this groundswell, I don't understand why we're listening to somebody from Berkeley, California, or Chicago, or Washington. That, to me, I think we got to worry about what the people are saying here. And we didn't hear testimony, really pushing forward with this initiative. Keep it the way it is. It works. And by the way, servers and bartenders are entitled to the minimum wage. If they don't
sure.
make it, they just have to talk to the owner who has to make it up at the end of the shift.
Absolutely.
It's already law.
Yep,
they're already guaranteed that wage.
Already there in state law. Republican State Rep Steve Ware, 55th District, Glastonbury, Hebron, Marlboro, Andover, and Bolton. Steve, good to have you on. We'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
Appreciate it. Steve Ware.